Okay, so our Jod Bite this month is with Jodcast stalwart Dr. Megan Argo. So, hi Megan.
Hello.
This is a bit of a weird one for me because normally when I'm interviewing, I don't interview very often, but when I do, I usually plan it quite carefully and I have a list of questions and I tick them off as we go and make sure every point's covered and describe the person I'm talking to and where they've worked and everything. I don't think I need to do that with you so much. I think we need to have a serious talk about what it is you're doing with your life.
Yeah, funny, my boss said that to me just the other day.
So this is a bit of a sad yet happy sort of event that's about to come up. Why don't you tell us what's happening with you?
All-time Jodcast listeners who've been with us from the beginning or anybody who's listened to the archive will know that I was there at the very beginning of the Jodcast way back in 2006. And I've left Manchester once before. I went off to Australia for 3 years and then I was 2 years in the Netherlands and I came back again. And now I've been back in Manchester 3 years and it's time for me to move on yet again. I'm not going quite as far this time. I'm only going basically up the road for people who don't know UK geography. I'm going to Preston, which is just up the M6. It's about, 30, 35 miles from here, something like that. So I'm not going too far, but I am leaving Manchester again for the time being.
But you're saying living where you're living now, you'll still be sort of local to the area. You'll just have a bit of a longer commute.
That's right, yeah. So I live not far from the Jodrell Bank, the Lovell Telescope. So I'm going to stay there and I'm going to commute to Preston. So it's going to be a lot of driving. But it's an exciting change for me. I'm going to be doing some teaching, which I'm quite looking forward to because I haven't done much teaching. And it's one of those things that's part of the academic career path is doing some teaching undergraduates and helping the next generation of astronomers come through and actually learn the basics.
Yeah. So is this a teaching post you're going to primarily?
Primarily, yes, it is a teaching job, although hopefully I'll be able to keep my hand in with some of the research that I've been doing here, working on the nearby galaxies and working on eMerlin, of course, our network of telescopes that we run from Jodrell Bank. I'll still be involved with that, but just to a lesser extent.
So will you still be doing? You'll still be at Jodrell Bank to some extent, then. You're not leaving us completely.
Yeah, that's true. I will be. When I can, I'll be spending some time at the observatory to carry on some research and keep collaborating with the same people I've been collaborating with since I did my PhD, which is some years ago now. Because of course, research projects they often take a long time to complete, so you can't necessarily finish everything before you move to a different institute. So some of that stuff will still carry on.
So there's plenty of overlap.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what is it you're going to be teaching? Do you know yet?
Yeah, so I'm going to be teaching first year astronomy, so the introductory astronomy module, which would be quite exciting because that's always good fun. So the students come to university knowing sort of A-level physics, maths, chemistry, maybe, but they don't necessarily know a lot of astronomy formally anyway. So the first year undergraduate astronomy is teaching them the basics of how the sky works, what the coordinate systems are, how spectra work, and what the star is and what a galaxy is. And there's a lot of basic stuff that's covered in there, but there's scope to take it further if people are interested as well. I'm quite looking forward to that.
And you'll be taking them through the initial hell of actually converting between coordinate systems as well.
Yeah, that'll be good fun. Yeah, a little bit of trigonometry in three dimensions required which is always...
Spherical geometry.
Yeah,
always great way to start a degree.
Of course, I'm going to have to go and brush up on this stuff too, but it's probably a good idea.
So you've been with the Jodcast for a very long time now. And before I even started studying astronomy at all, I used to listen to the Jodcast. So I knew your voice long before I ever met you.
Wow.
And back in those days, I had no idea that I'd actually be running the Jodcast.
So I have to ask then, do you have, because I know I listen to Radio 4 a lot, and I have a mental image of what the presenters look like on the Today programme. Did you have a mental image of what the Jodcast presenters look like?
I did, yeah. And when I actually met you, you kind of look similar to what your voice suggests you look like.
Well, that's reassuring.
The other person, I recognise you by your voice long before I actually met you. I was like, that's Megan Argo's voice. And then for a while, we weren't introduced for a while, but I knew who you were.
Right.
And the other person was Matt Perver.
Right.
Who does not look like his voice. At least my brain didn't model him in the way that he actually looked. So that was quite strange. And yeah, it was, I've known you longer than you've known me. So can you remember what was the first thing you did for the Jodcast?
I remember having the first sort of planning meeting. So this was after Stuart came up with the original idea. Stuart and Dave Holt, they've been talking for a while. And they'd had this idea. And we had a planning meeting. It was in the tea room at the observatory. And there were probably about 20-odd people in the room. And we all sat down and we talked about, ideas for the podcast and what we could possibly do and tried to work out, okay, who was going to do what. And the first bit of recording I actually did, pretty sure was the news for the first episode, the January 2006 episode of the Jodcast.
Wow.
And the reason I volunteered to do that in the first place was because I'm a member of Macclesfield Astronomical Society. And at the time, the meetings were at the observatory in the lecture room in the evenings. And for that meeting at the observatory, I was doing a quick roundup of what had been in the literature in the last month so that people could, you know, get an idea of what was going on in the professional circles. Mm. So as I was doing it anyway for Macclesfield Astronomical Society, I volunteered to do it for the Jodcast. And I carried on doing that way longer than I was involved, you know, running things for Macclesfield Astronomical Society. And it just kind of carried on.
You even carried on after you left for the first time, didn't you?
I did, for quite a long... For the entire time I was in Australia, and I think for the first half of the time I was in the Netherlands as well, I carried on doing the news.
So take me back to that first, your first instance on the Jodcast. Were you a PhD student at the time?
I was, yeah.
Had you done any outreach before, or was this a completely new thing for you?
No, I've been doing some outreach. One of the reasons that I started getting involved with the outreach was because, to be quite honest, I had a pathological fear of public speaking. I hated standing in front of an audience.
Right.
And when I was a student, of course, the researchers were all at the observatory next to the visitor centre. And it was quite a small visitor centre at the time, because around the same time I started my PhD, they demolished the old planetarium. And they'd actually taken out a lot of the old buildings as well. So the visitor centre was much smaller than it had been previously. Mm. And there were a lot of visitors who would come, and there was not a lot there for them to do. There was a small exhibition, there was a shop and a cafe, but there wasn't a huge amount to do once you'd seen the telescope and been amazed by the all 76 metres of it. So one thing I started doing was, because I knew the ladies who worked in the shop, and they'd often say when I go over for lunch, they say, "Oh, Megan, can you just, this person over there has asked a question and we can't answer it because none of them were scientists." And then, yeah. You know, they get asked questions all the time, but, "Oh, what's the telescope looking at?" And because they didn't know the answers. So when they saw me appear, they go, "Oh, Megan, can you just go talk to this person?" And I thought, this is crazy talking to one person at a time like this. Why don't we bring back something that happened sort of 20 years ago, which is the Ask an Astronomer sessions. Mm. Where the public would sit around in, they had an outdoor amphitheatre there at the time, or we used to use a 3D theatre indoors when it was raining. And the public would sit down, and I'd talk to them for 10 minutes about the history of the telescope and about some of the research that went on, and then ask them if they got any questions. So they could ask me, you know, any question that you ever wanted to ask an astronomer, but were too afraid to ask, preferably astronomy related. and they'd ask questions. And it was really scary when I first started doing it, but I got over that fear quite quickly when I realized you get the same questions pretty much every time you do it. It's yeah. The same things people want to know about. What happened to Pluto? Is there a planet 10? You know, have you ever seen aliens? These kind of questions. There were obviously other questions as well. The best one I ever had, I think there was a 10-year-old girl asked me how much power the motors drew on the Lovell telescope.
Wow.
When it moves in azimuth. I was like, wow, that's a brilliant question. I have no idea, but I know who to ask. Stay there, I'll be back in 10 minutes. And I went off and found an engineer and came back and gave me the answer. I can't remember what the number was now. This was, you know, 15 years ago. Yeah. But that's how I got started in doing the public outreach. And that helped me get over that fear of public speaking, which has, you know, been a great benefit to me, you know, throughout the rest of everything else that I've done. But
so that first time in the amphitheatre area, what sort of audience size did you have to deal with?
It was probably somewhere between 40 and 50.
Quite daunting then, for someone who's never done it before.
Yeah.
How did you feel?
Absolutely petrified.
Do you think it showed in how you were speaking?
I think at the time it probably did. And to be honest, a lot of that fear has not gone away. I've just found better ways of dealing with it.
Right.
So I'm better capable of hiding that fear when I stand in front of an audience. To the extent where people now don't believe me when I tell them that story about being petrified standing in front of an audience.
So how do you deal with the stage fright then? Because you do quite large. You were recently at Astrofest on the same bill as Brian May.
That's right.
Which must have drawn a huge crowd. How do you deal with an audience that
They
size?
Had a capacity audience in that room, and it's the Kensington Town Hall. There were 800 seats in that room. That was a bit scary. But to be honest, once you get to a certain point, the size of the audience doesn't matter. It's the same talk you've given before. And I was very confident in the material. Mm. So I knew that wasn't going to be a problem. And the audience in that particular environment, they're not going to have time to ask questions either. So it's usually the questions people get scared about. Oh, what if they ask me a question, something I don't know the answer to? But the more you do it, the more you realize that actually you do know what you're talking about. It's not a problem and you're fine. And it's, you know, And after a time, you just kind of get used to the feeling of fear and just become better able to deal with that thing. And it does take time. It took me a long time. But it was it was my PhD supervisor that suggested it in the first place.
Who was that?
Alan Pedler, Professor Alan Pedler, who's retired now. But yeah, I told him that I was scared of speaking in public when I was a student. And he said, well, you're going to have to get over that if you're going to be a scientist, because it goes with the job. You have to go to conferences and speak to the public. So, yeah.
And I think in general, a little bit of fear does help, but you should never go on completely calm.
No, a little bit of adrenaline is a good thing. I think it keeps you on edge and keeps you on your toes, and yeah, does help, I think.
And keeps you to time as well, because it sort of speeds you up, a little bit as well.
Yeah.
And stops you running over, I find.
That's right. It's a very, it takes practice, I think, for most people to actually give a talk to a particular time length. And at a conference, that's normal, right? You go to a conference and you have a 15-minute slot, of which, you know, 12 minutes you're supposed to speak and the other 3 minutes are for questions. And there's usually somebody there keeping time. And if you start to run over, they'll, one, start waving at you. And if you keep going, they will get up and they will start moving towards you and move you off the stage forcibly if you get too bad, you know. I've seen some very funny chairmen at conferences try and handle that in different ways. So keeping to time is a very, very useful skill.
Yeah, it's a skill we've lost in the Jodcast recently, because the shows have ended up gone from being about 40, 50 minutes long to now about 90 in general. So,
well, you know, if people are still talking and it's still interesting, then...
I hope it is. Yeah. But no, I think audience size is a weird thing, because you're kind of tempted to think that a bigger audience, the scarier it is. But I actually find smaller audiences much worse, because you're being judged by fewer people. You're more aware of each one of them's eyes.
You can see their faces. And
you get far worse questions from smaller audiences, because it turns into a discussion rather than a more formal question-answer thing.
Some of the longest discussions I've ever had have been after things like University of the Third Age groups, doing those for evening talks for the public. Mm. They are really interesting people, and usually they're more subject specialists. So you'll go to a University of the Third Age group who are science and engineering people. So they'll have had careers in science and engineering and they're now retired. That's what University of the Third Age is, and they're still interested. They want to learn. And yeah, they ask some really deep questions, and you really have to think about how to answer those. They're very different to a school audience.
You did your PhD here, then you did you do a postdoc here as well?
I did some of a postdoc here, yeah. I stayed on for about 18 months before I moved on.
And then you went over to Parkes?
To Perth, to Perth, Western Australia, yeah. Right. Parkes is on the east coast, yeah.
But you did use Parkes when you went over there, didn't you?
I did. Parkes is, most of the time it runs as a single dish instrument, so it uses it's used to look at things like pulsars.
Yeah.
But it can and does participate in the Australian Very Long Baseline Interferometer setup. So when they do that kind of thing, then Parkes is part of the network and they need people on site to run the telescope. So yeah, I've done a couple of sessions there where I was there for a week, and me and another observer would do 12-hour shifts each running the telescope. And I'd usually do the night shift because it meant I could play outside with the camera as well, take photographs of the night sky while the telescope was running. They have a dead man switch, so you have to run in and press a button every 15 minutes. So you can run outside with the camera and then run back in and press the button, then run back outside, grab the camera, set it up where you want it, come back in, press the button, run back outside and set your exposure running, and then...
Yeah, I've been there. It's like a higher frequency lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting place, and the kangaroos are very friendly.
I never saw one. I didn't see a single kangaroo when I went over, which I was completely disappointed by. I saw lots of posters with pictures of different creatures on, and say if you see any of these things, just run.
Right, yeah, there's a lot of poisonous nasties around there.
But yeah, no wildlife at all I saw when I was there. But you must have got some great pictures. I mean, that telescope at night looks beautiful.
It's a stunning telescope, yeah. It's very, very photogenic. Single telescopes tend to be very photogenic. VLBI arrays tend to not be, because they're spread over the size of a continent. It's very hard to take a picture of that. But individual antennas are, very, very photogenic. And the Parkes telescope, when you've got all of the floodlights on at night...
It looks amazing.
Yeah.
So what were you doing with it?
Well, as I say, I was there for VLBI, so we were running it as part of a network. So it was not my observations that were happening at the time. I was just there as an extra pair of hands to help run the observations and make sure things were running. So it wasn't my data that were being collected at that time. But I have done observations with that set of telescopes on nearby galaxies.
So going back to your research, what is it you work on specifically?
So mostly I study nearby galaxies. So galaxies that are close enough to us that we don't usually describe them with a redshift. So Z equals blah, blah, blah. They're close enough that that becomes irrelevant, because the motions of the nearby group are different. They're sort of more significant than the redshift would be. So I study nearby starbursty galaxies, so galaxies that have massive periods of star formation, and that's often due to a merger or a close interaction with another galaxy. So Jocast listeners from old have probably heard me talk about M82 in the past, which is one of the nearby starburst galaxies. And it's kind of the prototypical starburst galaxy. It's one of the first ones that was recognized as a starburst.
Mm.
And it's really exciting because it's having a close encounter with M81, which is a lovely grand design spiral. And the close encounter, they've not actually passed through each other yet, but the gravitational interaction so far has actually caused a lot of disturbances in the core of M82. So the reason we call them starbursts is because you have a certain amount of gas in a galaxy, and that gas is what forms stars eventually. And if you calculate the normal star formation rate of a galaxy and you calculate the amount of gas in the galaxy, you can calculate how long it will be before the galaxy runs out of gas at normal star formation rates. You look at galaxies like M82 and you do the same calculation. You look at how fast they're forming stars. You look at how much gas is in the galaxy and you calculate, well, if it was forming stars at that kind of rate for its entire lifetime, there should be no gas left in the galaxy right now. But we do see gas. So this period of massive star formation must be fairly short-lived and must have started fairly recently.
Mm.
So something has triggered that star formation. So M82 is a nice example. There's another one in the Southern Hemisphere called NGC 253, which is another nearby example. The advantages of studying the nearby ones is that we can see them in a lot of detail with our radio telescopes. So we can study them quite close up. We can work out what's going on. We can see how much of the emission we're seeing from them is from star formation processes, how much of it is from accretion processes, so black holes and so on. And then we can apply that kind of knowledge to more distant galaxies out in the universe that do have a redshift, that are far enough away that that's how we describe them.
Mm.
And then, yeah, we apply the knowledge we get from the nearby systems to understand the more distant ones where we can't resolve them in the same amount of detail because they're further away, they're harder to see in detail. So in using that, we can interpolate then over the star formation rate history of the entire universe. So
as you go to higher redshift, are there any other variables you have to consider?
As you go to higher redshift, you tend to see more examples of very active black holes, and they can, certainly in the radio, they can overpower the rest of the emission coming from the galaxy. Mm. If you've got a supermassive black hole in the middle of a galaxy, every galaxy that we look at, we go looking for evidence of, we find evidences for a supermassive black hole in the middle. When you go out into the distant universe, you start to see more of those supermassive black holes being very, very active. They're swallowing material from the surrounding accretion disk. They're generating a lot of radiation in the X-ray and in the radio and the ultraviolet. And all of that emission tends to overpower the rest of the emission from the galaxy. It's orders of magnitude more intense than the emission from the rest of the galaxy. So it becomes very hard to study the galaxies themselves. But we can still study the active galactic nuclei, those active supermassive black holes, the AGN as we call them for short. And again, we can use those to kind of trace processes, trace the history of what's happened with the star formation and galaxy evolution over the course of the universe.
And does the fact that these actually have an accreting supermassive black hole in the centre, pumping out all kinds of energy, does that actually do anything to the star formation rate in these high redshift galaxies?
There's evidence that it does. There's a lot of discussions over how much that that process, that, you know, the jets coming out into the galaxy actually draws material away from the centre of the galaxy, you know, pulls out the gas, so actually quenches the star formation. There's all kinds of different models as to exactly what goes on in these processes, and it's one of those things where there's a lot of theoretical models and there's a lot of observations, and trying to tie the two together is where we currently are with that kind of observations.
So is being in a starburst galaxy our future then, given that Andromeda is hurtling towards us?
That's right. Andromeda is moving towards us at about 200 kilometers a second, which sounds quite fast, but then if you actually work out how far away it is, it's not actually going to reach us for about 5 billion years, which is about the same time scale as what the sun's going to run out of fuel as well. So it'd be an interesting time. If I had a TARDIS, that's probably where I go. I'd like to see that collision. But yeah, you're quite right. In the future of the Milky Way, yeah, it will eventually become a starburst galaxy. It will merge with the Andromeda galaxy. And the individual stars are unlikely to collide because the stellar distributions, the stars kind of pass past each other.
Yeah.
It's very unlikely that any two stars will actually hit because there's quite a lot of space between the stars, even in galaxies. But the gas distributions in the galaxy, the gas clouds, collide more like candy floss.
Mm-hmm.
They will actually collide, and the shock fronts set up by that collision will start a lot of star formation happening. So yeah, in the future, the Milky Way and Andromeda will be full of new stars forming, massive stars forming, massive stars explode a supernovae. So there'll be lots of supernovae going off.
Yeah. So will we end up with an active core in our resultant galaxy after this collision?
It's highly likely. So a lot of the time we see galaxy collisions, we see a lot of supernovae. There's one particular example called ARP 220, which is a really nice example of an active galaxy system. And the star formation rate in ARP 220 is massive. It's very, very, very high. And it's what you see when you look in the radio is you see the two cores of the two galaxies. And the reason you can see them is because there are supernovae going off in those two cores on a regular basis. Mm. So if you go back and look at this galaxy every 6 months, you'll see another couple of supernova remnants appearing in the galaxy. It's a very, very, wow. very high supernova rate. In our galaxy, we haven't had one for 400 years. Yeah. So it gives you an idea of just how extreme the star formation rate is in ARP 220. So far in ARP 220, I don't think there's there's some evidence that there's an active galactic nucleus. But when you have galaxies colliding, then you disturb a lot of the orbits of the gas as well. Mm. So normally in a galaxy like the Milky Way, there's a supermassive black hole in the middle of our galaxy, Sagittarius A star. It's not emitting very strongly in the radio or in the X-ray because it's not currently active. Mm. There's no material falling into it. When we get close to the Andromeda galaxy, the gravitational interaction of the two galaxies will start to push some of that material out of its stable orbit. And some of that, if it goes the wrong way, it will start to spiral into the black hole. And then the black hole will become more active and we'll start to see more emission from it. A few years ago, there was a gas cloud called G2, which was its orbital trajectory when we plotted it, looked like it was going to pass close enough to Sagittarius A star. It was going to get swallowed by the black hole and would create a new period of activity. And there was a massive monitoring campaign. And as so often happens in research, when you go looking for things like this, the gas cloud did pass by the black hole, but not quite close enough. And there was no massive burst of radio emission or X-rays from the central supermassive black hole. So disappointing.
Such a shame. That would have been so good.
But, you know, there might be one on its way there now that we haven't seen yet that might hit it in a few years. So it's unpredictable, most of this stuff.
Excellent. So how long is it before we're going to see the Andromeda galaxy looming over us in the sky?
Well, there's been some simulations. A few years ago, there was a press release from NASA, I think, that had some images, some simulations of what the sky will look like over the next 5 billion years as Andromeda gets closer and closer. And it will look pretty spectacular. I think in about 3 billion years, it will be filling most of the sky. So it will look very, very impressive.
And star formation, this burst of star formation, will that have begun by then as well?
Possibly. Certainly the gravitational pull will have started to influence the galaxy by then, I would have thought. So, yeah.
Well, we won't be around to see the view, sadly.
Sadly not. We might build a time machine by then.
You never know. I'd quite like to see the view of the Milky Way from the Magellanic Clouds. I think that would be...
That would be pretty spectacular
as well. A
really
cool thing to see. Mm. So when you left to Manchester for the first time, you carried on doing the Jodcast. Why was that?
Partly because I enjoyed it, partly because it was a good way for me to keep up to date with the current research literature. It forced me to read, you know, a lot of papers every month, and I read them in a lot more depth than I think I would have done if I wasn't doing the Jodcast news. So yeah, I did enjoy it, but also partly because I don't think anybody volunteered to take it over. and that's the problem with the volunteer podcast. If, you know, you do volunteer for something, you are kind of stuck with it.
But of course, you won't be necessarily staying to do anything with a Jodcast as you're leaving this time, because you've gone on to do another podcast.
Yeah, so Seldom Serious was because we did enjoy talking to each other, and we're all still passionate about astronomy, even though some of us have gone on to do other things. Yeah. It's still, you know, what got us into studying at Jodrell Bank in the first place was because we're all interested in astronomy. So, hopefully people are enjoying our random ramblings, and they are sometimes a little bit rambling because we don't have as much of a plan usually as a Jodcast episode does. Yeah. We don't have interviews, so we pick a topic or listeners suggest topics and we just kind of talk about it for a while. So recently we did one on dark energy.
Yeah.
And they nominated me to talk about dark energy. I don't study dark energy. I had to go do a lot of reading. I hope I got it all right.
It's good though, because it keeps you broad.
Absolutely. And that's part of the problem with any kind of academic research, I think, is that the tendency is to get narrower and narrower and narrower and just focus on your particular topic. Whereas, yeah, doing things like the Jodcast, Seldom Serious, other kinds of public engagement, you know you're going to get questions on the whole field from the audience and you can't predict what they're going to be. So it's a good idea to keep up to date with as much of it as possible.
So when do you start your new job?
Monday.
Wow, really? That quickly?
Yeah. So we're recording this on Wednesday. Yes, so it's very, very soon. It's that soon because it's a teaching post, and that's when the start of the academic year is. So
I guess so, yeah. It feels much earlier in the year than it is to me at the moment. So you'll be going through the doors at Preston straight into a lecture theatre then, pretty much.
Pretty much. I start Monday morning and I go to, I think I've got a meeting with human resources at 10 o'clock, and then Tuesday afternoon I've got my first lecture. So
Wow. Are you nervous?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. I've got all the lecture notes and I've been through the first few lectures. So yeah, there's the first year astronomy, then there's some first year statistics I'll be doing next semester, and the foundation year maths as well, which is basically sort of A-level.
Yeah.
Level maths. So
we're still going to see you around. You're still going to be here on Friday. So hopefully we haven't heard the last of you just yet.
I hope not. It's always fun to come back and record with the Jocast.
Yeah. So maybe you'll do the news for us at some point.
Yeah, I'd be
happy I think the phrase, if you see the phrase written down in the news this month, most people hear it in their heads in your voice.
You know, when I start recording anything now, I always do a level check, and that's the phrase that I use.
Really?
In the news this month, because I just said it so many times.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, the very best of luck. We hope to hear from you again. I'm sure we'll see you around the department, but
yes, absolutely.
Listeners, we'll try and get Megan back as often as we possibly can. Thanks very much for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.